Architecture forgot to build one critical thing, its own support system. That operational chaos you feel every day, it's why your best people burn out. Why project fees get eaten up from design conflicts being discovered during construction. You have projects not making any profit, and why you're still working after your family is asleep. That's the daily chaos most architecture firms face because practical training is missing from the start. Hi, I'm Caitlin Rosier, an architect on a mission to fix this. The Mentor Dino Academy is your firm's secret weapon for giving you your time back and boosting your bottom line. It's the training system that bridges the knowledge gap, helping your teams master the skills they need to work smarter, reduce costly mistakes, and build a more profitable firm. Stop the chaos. Visit MentorDino.com to learn more. The Academy is the tool to fix the chaos, and this podcast is where we share stories and perspectives that inspire a better way forward.
Hello, and welcome to the Mentor Dino podcast. I'm your host, Caitlin Rosier. I am an architect and founder of Mentor Dino. Join me each week as I speak with amazing professionals in and around the architecture, engineering, and construction industry, as we are all part of a larger interconnected community. We discuss everything from career stories, lessons learned, and advice for others finding their own unique career path. Thank you to all of our current subscribers, and if you're new, welcome to the conversation. And if you like this episode, please do me a favor by hitting subscribe, like, or share it with a friend. It really helps others be able to discover this resource and support them on their own unique career journey.
On this episode of the Mentor Dino podcast, we're going to talk about alternative ways to practice architecture, whether it being starting your own business and practicing architecture a little bit differently when you start a traditional architecture practice and maybe you need help with getting some initial work in the door, and a design build side where you may just want to run a lean practice and not have too many formal employees under you. So we're going to take a different approach for this episode. So you can kind of see there are different paths rather than the traditional path of being in an architecture firm or starting an architecture firm after doing it all on your own. So let's dive in. So first off, we're going to talk about running a lean practice. And so this episode is with Ashton Brooks, and she was actually episode number 2. And so with Ashton, she helps with a design build firm that she actually runs with her brother, who is the architect, and they run a lean practice. So they're hiring professionals that are 1099s that can help get projects from start to finish. And they understand the standards, but not necessarily having to bring on full staff and having to pay for health insurance, PTO, and so on. So this was a way for them to run lean and being able to build up their practice. And if projects start and stop and that ebb and flow, they can be a little bit more agile with it since they don't have professionals directly as employees with them all the time. So let's dive in, and I'll let Ashton explain a little bit more on how to run a lean practice if you're looking to grow smartly. When you guys were starting the company, do you have any advice for somebody else looking to start their own firm?
Oh my gosh, so much. I think my background has lent itself to doing a very specific approach, specifically from the finance side. I would kind of like my two biggest pieces was understand cash flow. And then my second big piece is understand your sales cycle. So when you start a firm, sometimes life just leads you that way. Like there's so many architects that own their firm that I kind of like, hey, how'd you get started? How did you get your first clients? How did you, you know, branch off on your own? Most of them have told me stories that were very specific life circumstances that, you know, especially females, a lot of times it's like, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do the high demand while being a mom, and I had to quit. And then somebody just said, hey, will you design this for me? Or will you design that for me? And they start picking up these little projects. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, wait, like this is how they start. So for us, it was different in that we knew we wanted to start it and we were doing it together and the time was right. And we picked the niche market that we ended up being in. But what I think I was naive to this was that the sales cycle for it is really long. So, you know, we're a design build. We design financial institutions. So bank branches, credit union branches. When we do those, they're not little projects. Like if even for remodels, the normal low price kind of falls around $500,000 to build it. And that doesn't include, you know, going through the CDs, the actual design phase, if we have to do any market analysis for them, which sometimes we do, that's low end. So for somebody to have that chunk of money in their budget, they have to really plan ahead, you know, and then up, you know, some projects are multi-million dollar projects. So to get that sale just to where they sign the contract takes about 12 to 18 months from when we first start talking to them. And then after that, you still have a very long phase, probably another 12 to 18 months of everything you need to do in between then building, CDs, construction, et cetera, if everything runs smoothly. So knowing that, the money doesn't come in the door right away. And so if you're starting your own firm, knowing how long your sales cycle is for your specific niche of the market is key. Because if you're just like cold turkey, you want to start a business, you go for it, you file your LLC, all of that, you may have 18 months before you even get a contract. And that's if you're talking to clients day one. You know, they have to know you exist. So there's a whole cycle of sales that happen before that too. So yeah, that would be kind of advice one is know your sales cycle, know how long it takes. And then beyond that, know your cash flow. So, you know, obviously the design work that we do is not as, it's pretty much straight revenue, which is, or straight profit. But it's a much smaller amount compared to once we're doing the construction. So knowing kind of the curvature of when the money comes in and knowing how to manage that, what, you know, from an accounting standpoint, you say flatten the curve, really helps you manage your business. So if you're running lean and you're, you know, you have to pay certain employees, like, you know that the money's going to be there when payday comes, because payday comes more often than you're getting paid. You're just hoping, you know, that last payment can sustain. So really understanding deeply how your cash flow works and how to manage all the payments out is huge.
Yeah. Do you have any, I was a business minor, so I understand some of the more accounting and finance numbers and graphs, but I guess for somebody who doesn't have any business knowledge, what types of tips do you have for flattening the curve? So that's more like the highs and lows on when you actually get paid versus not paid, so you don't hit a lull.
Yeah. You can do a few things. One, if you just don't have any accounting skills at all, get yourself an accountant. Like, have somebody that can help you manage your books. And set up regular check-ins with them. You know, that's money well spent, even though it's kind of the opposite.
It's money.
Like, you're paying somebody to help you. Yeah. But keeps you safer. Hopefully it keeps you from any major pitfalls. What we do is we use obviously bookkeeping software so that I can manage it. And, you know, if you're an organized person, set yourself biweekly reminders to go in and look at everything and make sure you're getting paid on time and your invoices aren't behind, you know, for people paying you. Managing your own invoices, I feel, always helps in that you have very clear line of sight on, you know, your head is totally wrapped around who owes you money, when it's coming in, your billing schedule. We always do a net 30 payment, which is pretty standard for a lot of businesses, but understanding like, hey, okay, you tell your clients upfront, like you have 30 days to pay, knowing that if you have had problems with them in the past, putting penalties on it for them, which you hate to do because they're your clients, but you know, getting paid on time is key. Beyond that, how you structure the payments when it comes to construction is very much based on the type of construction you're doing and how big that is. A lot of companies will ask for 50%. Very common. We use something called a cost plus model where we add a things that they're just like, oh, okay, well, they need this, I'll get it to them. And they don't like count those hours, or they don't build them in from the beginning. So a lot of that comes with just learning on the job too. Like, how long will this take me? Because there's things that surprise you where you had an estimate out there for a certain amount, you guessed the number of hours, and then it ends up being a lot more. And the client is like, hey, you misquoted me. Like, you know, you're going to have some tough conversations. So some of that is learning. Some of it is in the beginning, you kind of figure out, ooh, I should have charged more. So
comes learning from past projects. Like I know putting in proper times and timesheets. So talking about working with your brother, and mm-hmm. you mentioned you keep the company lean. Yeah. Little disclaimer, I have worked at a design build firm that focuses on financial institutions. So like, it was PW Campbell here in Pittsburgh. They work kind of all up and down the East Coast. Okay. So that was my like little insert into like, oh, okay, now I know what the cash flow distributor things are. It's like, as soon as you get in a project type, you start to like
equipment. I know,
it's learn all the equipment.
Yeah.
But some of the places they would have me go, I'm like, wow, I'm in the middle of nowhere, but okay.
Middle of nowhere. Yes. There's a lot of middle of nowhere financial institutions. Yeah.
Yeah. So when I was there, I only did a short stint. It just didn't end up working for what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting seeing the amount of departments. I feel like they are bigger than what you guys are, but they had like a sales department, a pre-con. And then all the marketing and then a whole mini architecture division. So the architecture studio was separate. I'm just thinking of small firm and how you're doing design build. How does that structure work for you guys? How do you keep it lean and working through the process?
Yeah. So excellent question. Cause it is, I did structure this, I think, different compared to a lot of firms. So we started as a completely remote company from the beginning, pre-COVID. We thought we were geniuses. And then COVID hit and we're like, oh, everybody else is this way now? Shoot. But
not special anymore.
I know. Well, and it's kind of like this funny thing where it's like you're an architecture firm, but you don't have a location. Like, you don't have a building. So because of the market we're in and because we go to so many remote locations, we're not to our office anyway, because we, you know, go there. And, you know, you have more in travel costs, but we don't have the overhead of a building or a rental space. So that's one of the things that we do that's different. The other is that every project is different. You know, we know that the design side of it is my business partner, my brother. He's for sure the one doing the design. Because we have to go to so many places and in different states, the licensure changes and all of those. So regardless of if he's designing it or if we had other people on our team design it, we need somebody locally there that ends up doing the stamping. So because of that, we said, okay, well, we don't need this massive design team with all these different licenses in different places. What we end up doing is hiring a consultant to do the sign-offs. And that helps us in a lot of ways because there's some very different things in different places of the codes that change the way that you should build things. We have something in West Texas right now, and they have very unique soil, and building just the foundation is so different. So it's like having that local architect who has a license there makes a huge difference anyway, because we end up having better builds. So that's another thing. The other is a lot of our employees are 1099. So we hire them as need be for specific. So we don't have an interior designer on staff, but we have, you know, a handful of interior designers that we've worked with in the past that we go to have that done. And I think kind of what helps with that, like, that's not always something that firms like to do, because they're like, well, what if they're not available? Or what if, you know, this doesn't work out for them time-wise? We've found that if you treat them like they're full-time employees, or, you know, just go the extra mile to make sure that they get paid well on those projects when they are hustling, even when they're slammed, they still come back. I think they like working with us just because we're nice to them. And I know that seems so basic, but we try really hard to be. So it really does kind of help you find almost like partners that aren't even at your company. So
yeah,
that's another big thing that we do. And, you know, you're not going to need the same people on every job for specific reasons. We also, because we focus on financial institutions and a lot of them are community-based, and that's something that we actually value. We love community financial institutions because our dad was actually a manager of a savings and loan back in the day. It kind of is like a passion for us to work with them, and we want that money to stay within that community. So when we do subcontract work, we also hire out locally because that money stays with them then. So that's another thing that we try to do, which I would say that doesn't really speak to kind of keeping it lean. That's, you know, you pay a painter what you pay a painter. But yeah, so that also, I feel like, ends up resulting in clients being really happy, because a lot of times they know, oh, like this money is staying within here. It's not just going to this person that's completely and so that kind of just results in a good client relationship too, which in the end leads to more money.
Yeah. And then when you have the additional staff coming out, the 1099s, are they people doing this on the side and working full time, or are they just doing that part time, or is it their own thing?
It's a little bit of a mix based off of who we have now. One person, it's like their own thing. They do it as projects for us and for other firms locally where they're based. We're kind of like their one non-local one. And I think they appreciate the little bit of a change up. We do have somebody that does it as like a side hustle. And then we have another, a couple others that they have their own like engineering firm. So they get hired on like that as kind of their firm versus
anyway, but more being a consultant underneath rather than hiring out. So.
Yeah. So it is a little bit of a myth. Our biggest thing is that we just try to find good people that we trust. Being a small firm, we want to feel like we really trust them. And our approach is very much partnership, relationship building versus just like, oh, one-off hires or anything like that. And then we also do try, when possible, to hire females or minorities and or minorities. You know, there's, I think, a struggle with that when you're a young company, because it's like, okay, you get business and you have somebody you know, and they may not fit that label.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to just kind of go with who you trust. We've tried really hard to start networking and getting to know people outside of our company, but that are in the industry, so that we start building that trust even before we start working with them. And that's an ongoing process. I would say we're still not where we'd like to be with it, but we are actively.
Welcome back. Now I want to introduce you to Jenny Pison, episode number 45. She is a residential architect over in New York City. And for her, we talked about when she went off and started her own practice and actually how she shared an office space with another small firm owner and how they partnered together. They were helping each other. If somebody had a lot of work coming in, then Jenny could help that professional. Or when Jenny started having a lot of work come in and the other professional started to slow down, they could help her out on her project load. So it's a different way of practicing. And I think that's why I love interviewing small firm owners, because we find different ways to practice architecture and we find different ways to help each other out. And so if you're in a bind, talk to your other small firm owners. Somebody may be a little bit light on work or a project went on hold and they've got bandwidth that they need help filling up their time. Whether you're one that needs help filling up your time or you're one that's really swamped and you don't know how you're going to get it all done, you don't have to do it yourself. And there are ways to delegate the work without having to worry about if you have the full project load to bring on employee full time. So let's jump in to Jenny's episode, and Gano's episode number 45, and learn how it was starting her business.
Did they show you anything on like the financial side of the firm and like how to run the business, or was it more that BD networking to build those relationships?
Not as much. He did share contracts with us, so that was helpful to get a sense of like, because I think when people are working on a project, understanding like what the relationship with the client is, like what our responsibilities to the client are, and also like what are we billing for it. Like, it's just helpful to know when you're doing the work, like, okay, should I do this extra iteration or is this really not in the budget? You know, and like, I think in a small firm where you don't have like, you know, somebody who oversees that and like dictates that, it's important for the actual person doing the work to understand it. So yeah, so it was kind of a mix. Like, he didn't exactly like break down the how, what the like, you know, mm-hmm. office costs and all the expenses were.
Yeah. Not a complete open door.
No.
More than I've seen others.
Yeah.
So now transitioning to open up your own firm. I believe I read it was in 2016 that you decided to do that. How was that transition time? Because it sounded like it was more when you moved back to Brooklyn. Why did you decide to start your own rather than looking for a position at that time?
Yeah. So we had learned, my husband had learned that he matched with a fellowship in Brooklyn, which we were really excited about because we wanted to come back anyway. And so I knew like it was almost a year before I left my company in the Hamptons that I was going to be moving back to Brooklyn. So I had some time to kind of mentally prepare and prepare in general. And basically I told my boss at that time, like, you know, in a year I'll be leaving and I want to start my own firm. I think I always kind of wanted to, was something, an aspiration of mine, but I also feel like, you know, we were ready to start a family and I wanted some flexibility, and my husband's schedule is really rigid. He's a doctor. So it was like, one of us has to have some kind of give. And so I thought, okay, like, let me try to do some side projects and get something off the ground. Worst case scenario, like it doesn't work out and it's a total flop and I'll just get a job. But that was...
So you're doing the side projects prior to...
Prior, and I did talk to him and he said, yes, that's absolutely fine. You could do your moonlighting as a way to... And he actually gave me a client, which was really nice. That actually ended up leading to my biggest first project that I ended up doing, the house in the Hamptons. So it was... it was kind of like a slow start. So I was able to continue to work while I set up like the PLLC and like the logo and all the things, you know, the website, which didn't have anything on it, but you know, it's just like little by little.
Baby steps.
Yeah,
started.
Exactly. So, that was the process. And then we moved to the city and I pretty quickly got my first big job, which was really exciting. But also at the same time got pregnant with my daughter. So it was like a really crazy time when I was like doing this very stressful big project and also trying to navigate, you know, new parenthood.
Yeah. Cause at that point the clock's ticking and then it's like two different schedules running.
Yeah. But and that's the downside too of the business, is when it's also your first baby in a way. So, you know, when my daughter was born, I was like basically meeting with clients 2 weeks later with her, like, newborn next to me.
Yeah. Don't mind her. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly.
So what was the first big project you got?
Right. So it was, so this couple, whose apartment I ended up renovating in Manhattan when I was out in the Hamptons, they decided to build a house in the Hamptons. And that was kind of, really exciting for me. Just like ground up house, very high end, very beautiful. The clients had great taste. We had a very good working relationship at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So what types of projects do you work on within your firm?
So we're still doing mostly residential. We've done a few more commercial projects. We did a bar up in East Harlem. We did a dental office in Arizona. And we're doing, hopefully starting soon, a restaurant and also in East Harlem for the same client. But I would say the rest of it, mostly like 90% of our work is residential. And, it's, you know, everything from apartment renovations and combinations, to brownstones. And then we also do additions, not a ton of ground up work in the tri-state area. I am very lucky. My husband and I are building our own house right now in Brooklyn. And that is ground up. So that's pretty rare, but we were able to find, a site with a falling apart little house that we tore down. But, yeah, so I'd say it's all residential. It's really personal. It's a lot of working with, you know, families and couples and really trying to understand how they live and how we can make it better. And then recently, so in 2019, I pursued a passive house certification, just, you know, kind of looking around and seeing where the codes are going and where, like, kind of like what is the best practice for construction these days. You know, I learned about passive house. I did the training and now we're applying it to all of our, any project that has any facade work, we're applying passive house principles, which is like really important to me.
And do you have any advice for anyone looking to start their own firm? I know you moonlighted going into it, but shifting back to the city.
Definitely. So for me, a huge, huge like help was, this mentor that this woman, Carol Greder, who I had a friendship with from working at a different firm, and she had her own firm, but she was like, you know, 10 years older than me and 10 years more experienced than me. And, basically we ended up sharing a space, kind of, she was subletting from a bigger architecture firm. I was subletting from her. It was like a Russian dolls, like firm
three situation. architecture firms in one spot.
And, but it was great because, you know, we all had like access to a conference room and to a materials library, and also to each other's employees. So we were able to like, you know, kind of like throw ideas at each other. And it was really great. And whenever I didn't have enough work, I was able to kind of do some side work for her. So having that kind of like flexibility, and it was like a, you know, belt and suspenders, because if you didn't have a project, you never really know when the next one's going to come. It was just great to have. She always needed extra work. So I was like, okay, I could always pick up a few hours here and there if I need it. So that was a huge help. And just as in general, as a mentor, she was just like wonderful and continues to be. I'm having dinner with her next week. So we're staying very close. So that's one thing I would say, like try to find somebody that you can like learn from, but also maybe have like some, you know, what's the word? Like relationship where you can help each other, you know, whatever the term for that would be. Mm-hmm. So that's one. And then, I mean, talking to people, like networking. It sounds like everybody's, you know, everybody says the same thing, networking, but like you have to like meet the right consultants, the right contractors, you know, other architects. So I joined the AIA CRAN group, which is like the local custom residential architecture network group. Through that group, there's just so much, you know, so many people that are willing to help you with detailing, with like finding consultants, with how to deal with contracts, that, you know, really great. So like peer groups are good. I've joined a few networking groups to just like meet other professionals in the field. Because you never know, again, like in our job, like where is the next project coming from? It's a little bit of an unknown. So you have to try to optimize the potential for that. Like, so just by meeting people, I find it's really important.
Yeah, and really working on building a community around your firm, because I never really thought of making sure you could be a contract employee to another small firm. So if something flexes, you guys can help each other out along the way, and not thinking, you know, it's all on you to find all the work as you're starting to build the company, but leverage others and talk and help. Like, we don't know everything. So finding that support group to go ask questions as you come across different situations.
For sure. And I remember when I was starting, I was like, okay, I don't know everything. I think I know nothing. I'm like, I mean, I know some things, like foundational things, but I'm like, okay, I'm going into this and there's going to be like situations where I really don't know. And just finding, like, saying, okay, but I do know who to ask. Like, I have like this person and this person that can point me in the right direction. And that was really helpful. And like, just asking all the questions is the way to go. Yeah.
Welcome back. And finally, I got one more professional I want to introduce you to, and it's Erin Fontas. She is episode number 89, and she actually started her own business of senior architectural and interior designers to help firms. So if your firm is overloaded on work, needs help, but may not necessarily want to bring on somebody full time, or the project schedule is just not aligning with how long it takes to physically interview professionals, find somebody right for the job, and get them in the door and onboarded. So Erin's company actually can come in and you can show them the standards. You can have them in the backup or the queue for your projects if you have something come in the door they need to hand off. And it's not just a drafting service. They actually can help coordinate with engineers if they need to work with the clients directly. If you literally need to take a project and take it off your plate, you can hand it to a team, and you know you're handing it to senior professionals that know what they're doing and can take it from start to finish for you if you are overloaded. So let's dive in and learn a little bit more from Erin, how she started her business, and how it can really change how architecture is really done. When I was at my first firm, at the time, we had so many projects coming in. Staffing-wise, we were 14 people short. So we could have staffed 14 additional full-time employees for the workload. And you couldn't find the professionals that you needed. Yeah. And they did bring in some other service to come in to help with drafting work. But I feel like you almost need to train firms how to deal with 1099s and other professionals that aren't maybe going in front of the client and doing the client meetings, or maybe not in the office. But that was also pre-COVID.
Yeah.
And we weren't as used to like jumping around. So it's like these three individuals came in and they kind of, you know, get the reject seats. They don't have a desk. Like they're kind of sitting in a conference room. So it was just this weird dynamic. But now that you can be 100% remote and we're used to teams and calls and communication in a different way, I think it opens up so many more opportunities.
It does. And I feel like it doesn't limit firms to just their region or just like their city, you know. The nice thing about us is that, you know, we all have experience in architecture firms, like the traditional experience. We know what works, what doesn't work, how to communicate. We're basically looking at projects two steps ahead because we have that expertise and that understanding of what's needed. We're not someone that just got out of school. We're not co-ops. We're not those that you also have to like kind of mentor and handhold along the way. It's more of like a complete handoff if they wish, you know? But I think to the same notion, it's like, yeah, we might be a service team, but it's not like we're the outsiders. Like we can literally act as part of your team. We do communicate with external consultants for some of our clients. Like we'll be on engineering team collaboration calls and everything like that. So really it's like keeping a firm lean, but still having the professional expertise without having the handholding, the back and forth, or just per se drafting as well. So,
yeah. So how do you, I guess, since you've been on the contract side prior to having your own company and now, are there strategies that you use for your team so they feel more integrated to an architecture firm?
Yeah, so definitely. I like to look at us as kind of like a bridge of traditional and, you know, the contract. So everyone that works with us, we are all subcontractors. you know, to EF Designs. And really that is so that we get the tax write-offs, but we're still part of a group. And what's nice is like, we have our own internal task management system. We utilize Teams with internal and external. We have weekly meetings internally. Like we're women that like to collaborate, and we're women that like to get things done. So like, we're all just very into it. But you know, when I was working contract, I was a part of a team at that time and I loved it. But the issues that I had with it was that I was still being treated as if I were an employee. I had to be mm-hmm. on in between 9 to 5. I had to put in 40 hours of work. At the time, my daughter was only 8 months old. I was like, this is not really giving me the freedom that I wants. And so with us now, it's like, you know, if one of the girls has to go pick up a child at school or whatever, they can do that. And they don't feel like, oh my gosh, I have to hurry up and get back to the computer. You know, we create a margin and a very collaborative approach of, you know, when someone's in, when someone's out, but just being open, communicated, you know, like that's really all that it takes. You know, and then as far as like with a traditional firm, I feel like, you know, you have to have those 40 hours in, right? Like yeah. us, we're all billable. So it's billable time. If we have a low week, you have more time and more freedom. You know, if we have a high week, everyone's like, hey, we can be hands on deck. Like it just creates this culture of like, you just get things done. Yeah. You know what I mean? And you get it done efficiently and you get it done to the standard liking of our clients. So
yeah, because yeah. it's when those deadlines hit. Yeah. Everybody's got to ramp up in the industry.
Yeah.
And I find the problem we have when we hit those mental breakdowns and people wanting to leave firms and getting burned out, it's when you don't have the ramp down time. So mm-hmm. you don't have a light week that it's like, okay, I can counterbalance that. Hey, we had a big deadline we did a push for to make yeah. sure it was done. And now I get a little bit less of a week that I can spend more time with my family to make mm-hmm. up that time. And yeah. some firms are just on that constant high because they don't have the staff to yeah. get everything done. It's always yeah. deadline after deadline.
Yeah. And that goes back to just like, you know, boundaries and just like self-care, you know, like that. Those are like so important. Like that's something that I tell our team is like, take the walk, like I am all about boundaries. Like I don't have email on my phone. We don't text each other. We don't anything. Everything is just in a very, you know, boundary setting because they have their families. I have my family. And like when you're work, if you're not, then it's hands off, you know, mm-hmm. and just having those boundaries, I think is so important too with working remotely. So,
yeah. And I know as myself being a new mom yeah. with a 7-week-old, I know setting those boundaries are so important, but having these conversations, I didn't realize when I started my career that a 1099 contract position was even an option to be able to mm-hmm. do. So it's awesome that you've got two professionals that are still working through their license. Because mm-hmm. when I graduated, I thought I had to be at an architecture firm. Mm-hmm. My butt had to be in a seat 40 yeah. hours a week, if not yeah. more, and show up. Yeah. So how have you found your work-life balance been being more on the 1099 side rather than being in a firm from a parent's perspective?
Yeah. I mean, I love it. When I was working in a firm, you know, I was having to commute. And so I was spending 6 hours a week just to get to a job, right? 6 hours put back into being 1099, it looks like I'm cooking dinners. I'm going on walks during the day. I don't feel like my butt's glued to my seat. You know, if I have to pick up hours in the middle of the night to meet a deadline or to meet something that I said I would do, I can do that. You know, I feel like when you're working in a traditional firm, sometimes not every firm looks at those things to, you know, to the benefit. It's like they want you to be, you know, utilization rate of 80%, which I get, but sometimes, you know, what if the workload isn't there, you know, and your utilization rate is much lower and mm-hmm. you feel like you're just sitting at the firm or sitting in your seat just for the sole sake of sitting in your seat. Like I have a family. I can put more time back into my household and into my personal life that I need to fill up my cup to be the best person, best business owner, best, you know, mentor to those that I'm working with, if I'm filling up my own cup versus just sitting at a desk for the sole sake of putting in 40 hours a week. So
Yeah. Or drive. I always find it crazy when it's you drive into the office and then you're in 8 hours straight of meetings and you're already in meetings with people in different states. Yeah. So it's not like you're having a meeting in person. Everybody's there. The client's there. That is different and important to be there and in person. But if everybody's calling in anyway, why are you killing 2 hours of your day in a car when I can't really talk to anybody in the office? And the only time off maybe is a lunch break if I don't have a meeting during lunch.
Right. Yeah. So I just think there's a lot of like limitations of when you are working, you know, in a firm. I feel like there's just this culture that is just created, and like I know some firms are trying to get away from it, but then there's some that, you know, during COVID they didn't have the full remote. They didn't want to encourage that. So they're actually behind the times because they're not forward leveraging of the more openness and more opportunities that are available to them because they don't even know how to communicate on a more virtual level. Like, it's just kind of like you're stuck back here in like, you know, 2010 when we're all moving forward to 2030, and it's just, it's going to be a whole different world.
Yeah. And I think different priorities too for even the graduates coming out. It's, you know, you've experienced being remote, that it's an option, and maybe not everybody wants to be remote 100% of the time, but having that flexibility, especially as a parent, if your kid's sick, if I can still get my job done effectively at home, that gives me that flexibility. But if there's a day that if I can go in the office a couple of days a week just to be around people, have a change of scenery, do something else, having that flexibility in somebody's career is, I think, more helpful.
Yes, definitely. 100%. Yeah.
So where do you see EF Designs going in the future? I know you've grown a lot unexpectedly.
Honestly, it's wild. I feel like I have like these wildest dreams of things. So right now we are fully virtual. So everyone on our team is virtual. A lot of our marketing is targeted towards like just anyone across the US. And I am the type of person that I'm like, I am not meant to be behind a computer screen all the time. Like, I am a people person. I am an extrovert. I like to build connection, all of that. And, you know, working in Cleveland, Ohio for, you know, 8-9 years, like I have a wide range of individuals that I have known, connected with, worked with. And I'm like, I feel like I'm limiting myself of not, you know, going to them and saying, hey, here's what we provide. We're local to you. You know, we're not someone in, you know, across the seas, or, you know, like we can be completely local. I can be the face of that. So I personally see EF Designs being a firm that, you know, we're not an interior design firm. We're not an architectural firm. We are a production firm that, you know, as we work with these larger architectural firms, you know, they have a project manager or a project executive kind of heading this. Let's say they want to explore a new vertical market, you know, and we have such a wide range of experience that they could be like, hey, let's bring in EF Designs, and they can like do the production and be in calls, and they can learn and grow too as we explore this new vertical market without having to hire internally if it goes dead, right? I also see us moving into a direction where we have a local team that, you know, isn't everyone across the US, but maybe there's a local team in Cleveland that, you know, EF Designs has our own co-working place that we can be boots on the ground for firms in that local area. And maybe there's just a bunch of different areas around the United States like that. I mean, I think what we have here is very unique. We are not, you know, just drafters. We are like in like completely strategic planning of how we can work with another firm. And, you know, with having that experience, I think that leverages us very well. And we know and understand and live the day-to-day of the IBC and the IRC and the code and when it gets to and all of that, you know, so I feel like there's a lot of potential here, and I don't know, but I mean, there's dreams to be had. So we'll just see where it takes us.
Yeah. And so out of your clients now, is your team more taking running with projects, or are you guys more getting integrated with project teams?
So it's a little bit of both. We have a couple of firms that we're working with that, they'll have their SD phase pretty much completed and they'll hand it over to us and be like, okay, we need permit. Can you coordinate with our electrical engineers, our mechanical engineers, and can you work together to basically push this forward? Because what's happening is the project architects and the project managers, they're so bottlenecked up and they don't have that team to support. Where with us, like they're giving us that leverage to be like, hey, we know that you know your stuff. Can you just coordinate this and get this done for us so that we can go out to the site, have our client meetings, do all these things? But then we also have our clients who are like, hey, I love what we do. I know what we do, but I'm not technical. Like, we are more design oriented. Can you take our designs and put together construction documentation sets for us? So it's a little bit of both. But I think in both situations, we are more of that fully integrated. Just it looks a little bit different from client to client of what that fully integration looks like. So.
Yeah. What do you find? I know you mentioned some firms are more design oriented and having that knowledge base. Do you find there's a similar struggle that firms are having in their documents and their staff?
I think sometimes it comes down to like we primarily use Revit. That is like our bread and butter. And there's some clients that are like new to utilizing Revit that they don't know how to use it effectively. So when we get into these models, mind you, we are also positioning ourselves to seeing how multiple firms are utilizing this program in very many different ways. And it aligns us to see like what's working and what's not working.
Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed learning from three professionals that are doing practice a little bit differently. So, when you practice architecture, you don't have to do it alone. It doesn't mean doing the standard way of hiring professionals full time and on staff. And sometimes you need to ask for help, whether it be another firm owner or other services. So, highlighting from this episode on alternative ways to practice architecture and starting your firm, we had Ashton Brooks, episode number two, and it's a design build firm. And she talks about how to keep your firm lean and bringing on support without necessarily needing to hire staff to help do that. Jenny Pison, episode number 45, which is a residential architect out in New York City. And she talked about starting her own firm and partnering with other small firm owners to really help meet those financial means you need when sometimes it's hard to start a firm and bringing in those clients and helping others. And finally, Erin Fontas, which was episode number 89, and she started her own firm helping architects and interior designers whenever their workload is just way too much and they can't keep up and don't have time to hire somebody full time, and maybe just don't want to hire somebody full time but need help with their project workload at the time. And you can always leverage Erin and her team to hire senior professionals to take your projects from start to finish. So hopefully you enjoyed Ashton, Jenny, and Erin with this episode and learned a little bit of different way to practice architecture, whether you're looking for a different route or you need help on your projects. Feel free to reach out to any of these professionals to get more advice from them. I hope you enjoyed our discussion today. Learn some advice to take with you and see how our industry is all tied together to create the world around us. Check out the description below for any links or resources we discussed. If you liked the episode, please do me a favor and hit the subscribe button. Give me a thumbs up and leave a comment below. It really helps others be able to discover this resource and support finding that career path that best works for them. If you know someone that has inspired your own career that you'd like me to interview, let me know in the comments below, or you can reach out to me via my website or LinkedIn. I'd be happy to share their story or your own. Thank you again, and I cannot wait for the next career story I get to share with you next week.